Paper 11, section 5, sold single column, page 122. Okay, so this is the meat of this paper. You know, it's literally the center section of the paper. This is where it all comes to a head here. So we'll need to do a lot of work to step through this. We'll just take it, you know, take it slowly. We'll actually do quite a bit of reading, you know, to kind of get a overall sense, and then we'll go back and work through it. So, you know, as we start in here, just we're going to read straight through all three points there, you know, after the intro paragraph, and then we'll go back and pull things apart a little bit here.
5. Nether Paradise. Concerning Nether Paradise, we know only that which is revealed. Personalities do not sojourn there. It has nothing whatever to do with the affairs of spirit intelligences, nor does the Deity Absolute there function. We are informed that all physical energy and cosmic force circuits have their origin on Nether Paradise, and that it is constituted as follows. 1. Directly underneath the location of the Trinity is the central portion of Nether Paradise. In the central portion of Nether Paradise is the unknown and unrevealed zone of infinity. 2. This zone is immediately surrounded by an unnamed area. 3. Occupying the outer margins of the undersurface is a region having mainly to do with space potency and force energy. The activities of this vast elliptical force center are not identifiable with the known functions of any triunity, but the primordial force charge of space appears to be focalized in this area. This center consists of 3 concentric elliptical zones. The innermost is the focal point of the force energy activities of Paradise itself. The outermost may possibly be identified with the functions of the unqualified absolute, but we are not certain concerning the space functions of the mid-zone.
Okay. Now you can see that that's an initial little overview, and then they go into a greater detail about the outer region there, item number 3. But let's start with that. There's some really, really quite a few things all packed into that initial little survey they do there. Okay, so now, first of all, a lot of times, you know, over the years, we've talked about that basic individuality viewpoint idea of total will separating itself from, you know, the non-will. And then, you know, that will acting on the non-will and bifurcating it. You know, that basic notion of taking that which reacts, you know, to the actions of that which acts, you know, and bifurcating it, splitting it in two, separating it, pulling it apart. Okay? And once you have, once the first source and center has those two halves, now pulled apart and made two new holes. You call those two the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute. That whole image of drawing them apart, creating this literal separation, you can very directly, as I'll point out here, very directly think of the thickness of the Isle of Paradise as embodying that separation, okay, between the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute. Notice how they say that point blank here. Okay, in that first little preface paragraph before the three items, they're talking about, you know, they're referring to upper paradise. See, where the deity, you know, you have the identification of the deity absolute, and they're saying, you don't have that here. Okay? Nor does the deity absolute here function. And then when you got the end of item number three there, they're talking about the outermost may possibly be identified with the functions of the unqualified absolute. Okay, so see right there, on nether paradise, they're pointing to the unqualified absolute, and on upper paradise, the deity absolute. That separation made aisle. Okay? So, that's the first thing that you notice from the individuality viewpoint is that point of recognition and an additional understanding about that separation of those two reservoirs, the reservoir of the potential for matter, for material energy, physical energy, the unqualified absolute, and the reservoir of the potential for spirit substance, spirit energy, the deity absolute. Now, notice immediately he's challenging you to not try to understand all this with that individuality viewpoint, with the seven absolutes of infinity. How do you immediately notice that? Well, there's two things. Okay, first of all, there was something that, you know, you may not have known quite what to do with. In the middle of item number three there, where it said, the activities of this vast elliptical force center are not identifiable with the known functions of any triunity. Functions of any triunity. In the individuality viewpoint, the way that you go about trying to understand all of the complex functioning that goes into making the universe happen is you take those seven absolutes of infinity and you create all of these triplets. You know, with the triunities, one of the three is the Father. You know, we're just seeing that, the first source and center, that which acts. Okay, so you know it's the key element in all those triads that are the triunities, so that you have these acting like associations, threefold associations, those triunities. The functioning, the way of understanding the functioning from the individuality viewpoint. Okay, so but what does he say? You're not going to get there, okay? You can't understand this fundamentally from the individuality viewpoint. You know, you get a little bit of this additional perspective on the separation between the two and, you know, seeing it made thickness of the aisle. But when we want to start really understanding the functioning, we've got to let go of the individuality viewpoint. And notice that's seated in both spots there. You know, you had the deity absolute mentioned and the unqualified absolute mentioned, but in both places, was it spoken of as, from the individuality perspective as a reservoir? No, it was used as the substitute. Okay, first it said, nor does the deity absolute there function. Okay, and down here, the outermost may possibly be identified with the functions of the unqualified absolute. When you're talking about the functions, you're not talking about the individuality viewpoint where those are just reservoirs. You're talking about the unity viewpoint where it's a facet of deity in each case. Deity, that's what deity does. Deity functions. So what he's really wanting you to do is take what you've learned after having read through the whole book in paper 105, coming back to here, rereading this and going, oh, yeah, okay, we want functions here, not reservoirs. We want, instead of the deity absolute, we want the infinite potential to be what we're thinking about. The functions, you know, the function of the infinite potential, that facet of deity. And the unqualified absolute, we want the function of the infinite capacity. Okay, so in terms of functioning, see, we're talking about the separation between the infinite capacity and its identification with nether paradise, and the infinite potential and its identification with upper paradise. Okay. So that's the on-ramp to challenging the advanced student to start thinking about this with a little more unity viewpoint. Okay? That's the way he does it. He does it kind of the way we've seen they do most of the time. You know, the key word is function. Didn't notice that they're suggesting you bring in a little bit more of a bigger picture. Okay, so now that we have that, now that we know that we're not talking about upper paradise where you have personalities, you have spirit intelligences, that whole spirit energy, mind energy, you know, phenomenon. You know, we don't even have the functioning of the infinite potential. Okay, we have the other half of the picture, just like we're suspecting, just even from the individuality viewpoint. We have it's the nether side is about the parallel half of the whole picture of reality, the non-personal half of the picture. Okay, so with that, what's the first thing they say? Item number one, directly underneath the location of the Trinity, in the central portion of Nether Paradise, is the unknown and unrevealed zone of infinity. Okay, so now, first of all, okay, notice that they didn't say directly underneath the location of the three infinite persons or the deity presence or something like that. They purposely expressed it that way with the Trinity. Okay. And before I unpack it totally, let's remind ourselves of a very key sentence in the book about the Trinity. Right towards the end of the foreword, on page 15 in the single column, section 12 on the triunities, the second little paragraph there, there's the bottom of page 15. You know, notice how in italics it says the Paradise Trinity. Okay, right in the middle of that paragraph is a very important statement. Won't worry about all the details of the paragraph and why it starts with therefore, but just therefore does this Trinity, the Paradise Trinity, constitute the only deity reality embracing infinity. Okay. The Father is a facet of deity, doesn't embrace infinity directly. The Son, the Spirit, I mean, the sevenfold, I mean, okay. None of those facets of deity. You know, in a personal or impersonal way, none. The only deity reality embracing infinity is the Paradise Trinity. Okay, so if that's really burned in your head, it's like, wow, that's a really significant thing. That really sets that functioning facet of deity apart. It's the one that directly embraces infinity. So, you already noticed something's going on here. Okay? Right in that little sentence, they're associating the Trinity with the zone of infinity. Because it's the facet of deity that embraces infinity. What, you know, remember what infinity is, lowercase I, infinity? The totality of reality? Okay. Deity and reality, in that sense. There's deity, then there's reality. And of all those facets of deity, just one directly embraces infinity. Paradise Trinity. Okay, so now let's think about the greater details, you know, because they have other things there directly underneath in that whole image. Okay, so remember, you know, what we've just done. You know, we did upper paradise, then we did peripheral paradise, and now we're on another paradise. You know, if you go back to upper paradise there, so go back two sections, section three, remember we had the deity presence at the center of upper paradise. And then surrounding that was the most holy sphere, and then surrounding that is the holy area. Okay. Just focus in on the central part there. The deity presence surrounded by the most holy sphere. Okay, what did they say about that most holy sphere? It said that the vast region immediately surrounding the presence of the deities is set aside as the most holy sphere and is reserved for the functions of worship, trinitization, and high spiritual attainment. Trinitization. Definitely tied to the Trinity. Function. Okay. So when you have the Paradise Trinity, and we've talked about this a bit back in the Trinity paper, okay, there's just the Paradise Trinity as a fact, but then there's the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. It has this threefold functioning that we gave a name for each of those facets of functional expression. The Trinity of Absoluteness, the Trinity of Ultimacy, the Trinity of Supremacy. That's the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. Okay, so in other words, let's, restate what they're just telling us there. So they're saying that you start at the center of the upper surface, and you have the presence of the Universal Father, surrounded by the presence of the Eternal Son, surrounded by the presence of the Infinite Spirit, surrounded by the presence of the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. Mm-hmm. And that should ring a little bell if you remember when they tell you about when you're working through Havona and you're taking those trips back and forth to Paradise as you're trying to reach those milestones of the personal recognition of the Infinite Spirit and then the Eternal Son and then the Universal Father. That first time when they say you're going there to try to achieve the personal recognition of the third source and center. They say, well, you're put there, and no one needs to tell you where the shining of the Trinity is. Because, okay, you have the three deity presences, and then surrounding that is the functioning of the Paradise Trinity, the luminosity of the functioning of the Trinity totally, enshrouds the deity presence. So you see that. I mean, there's nothing enshrouding it, okay? There's no light over that, no bushel over that light, okay?
You don't have to achieve a recognition.
Right. It's just there, blazing, okay? Yeah?
Is the three concentric elliptical zones related to the three concentric circles?
No. The three concentric circles is related to the deity presence, the three concentric presences.
But they use it again here, though, too.
Yeah, but there's lots of threefold, yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so, you see that. You see the most holy sphere as a radiating sphere, okay? The trick is to try to somehow have the maturity personality actualization, that you can penetrate that spiritual radiance and actually discern, the first discernible personality through that incredible glare, if you will, of spirit energy. Can you actually pick out and recognize the Infinite Spirit personally through that glare of spirit? Right, you've got
to see what's under.
Right. They're called the Trinity guides. Okay.
Oh, that's it.
Okay. Anyway. So that's what you have on the upper surface. You don't have the Paradise Trinity per se. You have the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. And it's so literal. That's why it's given these proper designations, the Trinity of Absoluteness, the Trinity of Ultimacy, the Trinity of Supremacy, because, you see it. You literally see that. Okay, it's worthy of a proper designation with capital letters. Okay, what about the Paradise Trinity itself, directly? Okay. Now, remember, we even see that on the Infinite Eternal Ellipse chart. You've got the Paradise Trinity right there, just as a direct label. And then you had this whole circuit for the functioning of the Trinity. So, you know, the two are separate. And you know, we just pointed to where, you know, you can literally see this functioning of the Trinity. What about the Paradise Trinity itself directly? Notice the other thing that's there with it in this circuit, in the first functional level there. Purposely written in parallel so that you could see the parallel. The Paradise Trinity, the Paradise Isle. The Isle and the Trinity have something in common, the adjective paradise. That fundamental stasis that was in the I Am. Okay. They're alike. The Paradise Trinity and the Isle are, in some sense, of one flesh. They're alike. They're both embodiments of that stasis that is paradise. Okay. You can literally think of the Paradise Trinity as permeating the aisle. They're together as one in many ways. That they share the paradiseness. Okay. One manifests that paradiseness as aisle, and the other manifests that paradiseness as deity, but they have that in common. Okay. So as you go down, you know, you really are, you know, you're not just, you know, imagining that you're passing through the aisle. You're also passing through the fact of the Paradise Trinity, literally, directly. You know, and see something that's really not accessible, any more than, you know, being able to feel the interior of the aisle is accessible to anyone. You know, it's just an inaccessible fact, because it's paradise. It's completely, remember what they say in the foreword about how, you know, there's everything and then there's paradise. Okay, this is just a part. Paradiseness is a part. Okay. However, okay, you penetrate through the aisle, and there's a center point of the Nether Paradise Domain. Okay. Now, you know, we know that two things about the aisle. The aisle is the center of infinity. That whole thing that we're talking about, the Paradise Trinity, is the one facet of deity that directly engages, you know, that directly embraces infinity. The aisle also touches every point. It's the center of infinity. You want to think of it transcendently, not in the sense of, you know, it's this thing in the center where it's like, well, it's only directly touching the pieces of infinity that are glued to it, you know, and the pieces of infinity that are way off. Okay, no, it touches every point. Okay, so for the Paradise Trinity to be with it, see, is how the Paradise Trinity can directly embrace infinity. Okay, but there's more to the Trinity. There's still one more thing to the Trinity, an aspect of the Trinity that doesn't become manifest in terms of understanding until you get towards the end of the Total Deity Appendix, working through all of Total Deity. And you discover that there's another way to understand the fact that is the Paradise Trinity. This fact that directly embraces infinity. In other words, it is with infinity. Unlike any other facet of deity, it's literally with infinity. It's co-infinite with infinity. Okay, the Paradise Trinity is the co-infinite one. If you want a way to really speak of the Paradise Trinity as this definitive, non-personal individual, the Paradise Trinity is the co-infinite one. And where is that co-infinite one? Right there, directly beneath the location of the of the three of the deity presence and the functioning of the Paradise Trinity in a, you know, in that way that leads to personality and whatnot, directly at the center of the underside, okay, is the co-infinite one. Okay. Now, when you we've touched on this a couple times. As you start reading the book, you know, you're like, okay, finite, I get that. And then the supreme has some relationship to the finite. And then they start telling me about absonite, and that's apparently transfinite. And then they bring in this notion of ultimate, and I'm kind of getting the sense that the ultimate relates to the absonite, like the supreme relates to the finite. Remember how we pointed out that, you know, once you're ready, you've got a whole stack here. Okay? There's these four different levels of, you could just say actuality. And associated with each of those levels of actuality, there's a level of personality activity. First, there's the finite. And there's a fullness of personality activity identified with the finite is supreme. Finite, supreme. Then you just go up another notch. You have this actuality of absonite, the personality activity identified with it, ultimate. And then above that, you have the co-absolute, that's the actuality, and the personality activity identified with it is absolute. So absolute personality activity identifies with co-absolute actuality. And then there's one more notch above that. Co-infinite. And the infinite that's identified with it. Okay. Here's a spot where you actually need to think about those upper reaches. You got to go beyond the finite and the absonite and the supreme and the ultimate. Okay. When you see, we just started it. You know, what did we put at this? You know, we're down here in another paradise. We're not dealing with personalities and spirit intelligences or even the functioning of the infinite potential, you know, the deity absolute. Okay, so we're not really dealing with supreme, ultimate, absolute, infinite. We're dealing with finite, absonite, co-absolute, co-infinite. We're dealing with that separate, you know, the part that's separate from the personality activity. Okay. The highest thing of those is the co-infinite. Where was it? Right at the center, the co-infinite one. So, well, I wonder if I can just think causally outward from the center of Nether Paradise. You know, that I would maybe going from the co-infinite to the co-absolute to the absonite, heading out towards the finite. Well, zone number three, which we'll get into in quite a bit of detail. I mean, that's, like they mentioned, that's about the force charge of space. So, you know, as they mentioned it, the primordial force charge of space. It's all about that force charge that, you know, we contemplate as the foundation of physics out here in the finite. And the foundation of the finite physics is absonite. It has an absonite foundation. So that fundamentally, being a little simplistic here, but fundamentally, you've got the absonite is kind of the thing you're thinking about there in number three. So if I'm thinking about co-infinite number one and absonite in number three, what does that suggest about item number two? The thing that's in between the absonite and the co-infinite would be the co-absolute. It's like, okay, so what do I know about Nether Paradise that impinges upon the co-absolute? Okay, let's remind ourselves of one other thing. Way up in paper 118, remember Supreme and Ultimate, Time and Space, Heavy Duty, on page 1297, in the single column, that's paper 118, section 3, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 118.35, page 1297. The paragraph that starts out, space. Let's read that beginning and remind ourselves what they said there. They said, space comes the nearest of all non-absolute things to being absolute. Space is apparently absolutely ultimate. Okay, think about what they're saying. Put the pieces together. Okay, so I've got finite, supreme, absonite, ultimate, co-absolute, absolute, co-infinite, infinite. Okay, I'm working up something. What's the closest thing to the absolute, but is non-absolute? Okay. Co-absolute is the nearest thing to the absolute. Or think about that expression. Space is apparently absolutely ultimate. I have the ultimate, and then I move that towards the absolute, so I'm in between the two. I'm in the co-absolute. Most fundamentally, what are they saying there? They're telling you that most fundamentally, space is a co-absolute fact. In other words, it transcends the absonite, just like the absonite transcends the finite. It's going to also contain the absonite. It's transcendent to the absonite. The absonite is within it. Okay? So, item number two, back in paper 11, this zone, the zone of infinity, is immediately surrounded by an unnamed area. You know one thing that's identified with that area. Space. Because it's co-absolute. Okay. Let's remind ourselves, okay, when we did the individuality viewpoint and we got the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute as the two things that got separated, and we noticed that that was, you know, reflected in the thickness of the aisle. In the unity viewpoint, which he suggested we should really immediately start thinking in, okay, that's not the way the story goes in the unity viewpoint. In the unity viewpoint, total will separates itself from total deity. And then total deity, capital T here, in the presence of total will, differentiates into that which reacts and that which results. In the presence of that which acts, it differentiates into that which reacts and that which results. You know, obviously, that which acts is going to seek out that which reacts. See? It's going to differentiate that. Okay? And then you have the infinite one, the infinitude, and the infinity. Okay? The infinitude and the infinity, that which reacts and that which results. The essence of total deity, capital T, and the facience, the doingness of total deity. The essence and the facience, the beingness and the doingness, okay? Space and motion, okay? So in the unity viewpoint, when you differentiate the infinitude from the infinity, see, two things are, the aisle again, okay? The aisle embodies that differential between the infinitude and the infinity. Infinitude on the bottom and the infinity on the top. In other words, space on the bottom, motion on the top. Oh. So you go back to that paragraph right before section 3, right before Upper Paradise. Remember when it said, well, roughly. Okay. You know, and they proceeded to say, okay, from your initial simplistic viewpoint where you're your twofold thing is space and time. You can think space on the bottom, time on the top, you know, space originating, you know, off the bottom and time originating off the top. But then they immediately, you know, when they say time, okay, you know, that a sequence of events, and they say The citizens of the Central Isle are fully conscious of non-time sequence of events. Motion is not inherent on paradise. It is volitional. Immediately they suggest you need to let go of the simplistic thing of trying to think of it as space and time. It's actually space and motion, and time is the chronicity of motion. You know, it's an abstraction of motion. Okay? The real separation is space coming off of nether paradise and motion coming off of upper paradise. Ah, the infinitude and the infinity. See? Okay. All right. So you know. I mean, it's not a guess at all. They've told you flat out. You just put all the pieces together. You know that something on the surface of nether paradise has to be tied to the origination of space. We'll talk about this a little bit when we get into this paper, but just at this point, you know, think about, you know, space is such a static abstraction. It just is this thing, you know, it just is. How much is that kind of like the notion of what the word paradise means? It's fundamentally, it is the stasis. Okay, so it's not surprising these would be very closely associated. Okay, I mean, literally, when you talk about the paradise source and center, one of the things that it's the source of is space. Okay, and this is that source point. This is the second zone, surrounding the zone of infinity. Okay, so think about the picture you have then, 1, 2, 3. You have the direct embrace of infinity. And in that context, okay, you know, the totality of reality, in that context of the embrace of infinity, move out, you have space. And in that context, you have the force charge of space. See, obviously, just logically, I have to have originated space before I get to item number 3 here, because I'm already talking about the force charge. It's in space. So space had to proceed. Yeah, it did. It's item number 2. Okay. The co-infinite one, space, and then the force charge of space, and the immediate identification with the infinite capacity. Okay. That's nether paradise. Now let's unpack the details a little bit more. Yeah.
So at some other point in the book, they talk about the center of every automaton is paradise, right?
Okay. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Very important for the purposes here. Yes, it is true that the influence of the nucleus of influence at the center of every automaton, at the center of every physical fact, is the influence of the isle.
So would an automaton be designed like paradise?
Everything is designed like paradise.
Okay. Three concentric
paradise is the pattern.
Right.
Okay.
So everything is that.
Everything in one way or another is an expression of paradise. You know, it's not going to be in some simplistic way. But it's the paradise source and center, okay? But the important thing, before we start getting into the more details here, is set the whole automaton, nucleus of every automaton, all that thinking about the little individuations and understanding them, set that aside. We're not going to work on that right now. A lot of that is like paper 42. I mean, you know, you touch on it a little bit. But the main thing we want, especially in the rest of this section, big picture. We're not going to think about the influence of the isle so much, as a nucleus of, a nucleation, influence for particles. But we're going to think about how it imposes itself on the whole. Okay? So set the microscopic aside, and let's think about the macroscopic, the influence of the isle on the macroscopic. That's what we're going to focus on here. Okay? And so that's what they do here in these subsequent paragraphs. And what we want to, what I think we'll do here is, I'll have Jeanette, she'll basically read the next four paragraphs, everything except the very last paragraph of this section. We're not going to do it totally out. So there's a little element in each one of these that I want to bring out in context, but we're not going to talk about, you know, the main point of the paragraphs until we have all of them in front of us. The same way we did up here. Let's get the whole picture laid out. You know, we did the big 1, 2, 3. Now we're zooming in on 3, and we're going to do 1, 2, 3 again. Okay. And so, you know, that's what we want to, because we need to be able to talk about it all together so that you can really think about it clearly.
The inner zone of this force center seems to act as a gigantic heart whose pulsations direct currents to the outermost borders of physical space. It directs and modifies force energies, but hardly drives them. The reality, pressure presence of this primal force is definitely greater at the north end of the Paradise Center than in the southern regions. This is a uniformly registered difference. The mother force of space seems to flow in at the south and out at the north through the operation of some unknown circulatory system which is concerned with the diffusion of this basic form of force energy. From time to time, there are also noted differences in the east-west pressure. The forces emanating from this zone are not responsive to observable physical gravity, but are always obedient to Paradise gravity.
Okay, so two little sub-points in there. About a third of the way in there where they, it's the second sentence in there. It directs and modifies force energies, but hardly drives them. Okay, so first of all, remember, we're talking about just item number 3 in the previous 1, 2, 3, and we're breaking it up into these, you know, inner zone, mid zone, and outer zone. Okay, so, you know, basically what we're trying to understand is how Paradise is influencing the force charge of space. This ubiquitous presence, this substrate upon which all physical stuff is built. In the same way that, like, when we think about a mindal ministry, we have to have a mind energy presence, a mind energy substrate, you know, in and through which there is a mind ministry, you know, or we have to have a spirit energy substrate, and in and through it there's a, you know, there's spiritual ministry. Same thing, you know, in terms of physical energy, you know, this ubiquitous presence out here is the force charge of space. And so they keep, you know, they'll say force energies, for, you know, that's basically what we're thinking about. Not turning things into automatons and all that yet. We're just kind of, we're thinking about, see, the foundational level. Okay, and so now everything is in the universe is in motion except the aisle. So when you talk about this presence, this force charge of space, this fundamental fact that fills pervaded space, you know, or pervadable space and makes it pervaded, you know, makes it filled, okay, this force charge, this charge of force, okay, that fills that pervadable space. You know, it's a motion, okay. But see, they're trying to, you know, so the point of that is it directs and modifies force energies but hardly drives them. Don't think about what Paradise is doing here as initiating these motions. There's all kinds of motions. And don't think of what Nether Paradise is doing as driving those motions. Okay? That's a separate issue. Okay? As a matter of fact, in a lot of what we're going to talk about here, in terms of this force charge, kind of think of it a little bit more statically, kind of take a little bit of an individuality viewpoint, sort of it, you know, set aside the fact that it's actually a dynamic thing and start with an understanding that's a little bit more ether-like, okay, a little bit more of a static thing, okay, that's just this presence that we're going to try to, and And what paradise is going to do, because paradise is the absolute pattern, it's not going to drive. It's this directs and modifies. It's going to impose pattern upon motion. And so, you know, motion is not just going to be willy-nilly. Okay? All the complex motions that are initiated in the universe have a pattern imposed upon them. They get purposed. Okay? I mean, we don't have, you know, we're not talking about personality like purposing, but we are definitely talking about energy purposing. We want to impose pattern upon energy. Paradise is the, you know, is that absolute pattern. Okay, so that's another way of saying that. You know, think about it. There's motion and it imposes a pattern, and that motion then takes form. It's not just any old thing. You know, it starts to take form in the presence of these influences that they're going to be talking about. Okay, and one of those things, that last little sentence, the forces emanating from this zone are not responsive to observable physical gravity. Okay, so not Newtonian-like, not linear gravity, okay, but are always obedient to paradise gravity. And very much here, again, like I said, let's not think about, when you think paradise gravity, don't think the centering influence at the center of the ultimate. Let's think big picture. Big picture paradise gravity, macroscopic paradise gravity, okay, is circular gravity, quote-unquote, instead of linear gravity. You know, it's manifest, you know, in that all of the master universe has these levels, you know, these flows in circuits. You know, some counterclockwise, some clockwise, etc. You have all these circuits, these flows of the force charge. Okay? Circular gravity. All right?
The midzone of the force center immediately surrounds this area. This midzone appears to be static, except that it expands and contracts through three cycles of activity. The least of these pulsations is in an east-west direction, the next in a north-south direction, while the greatest fluctuation is in every direction, a generalized expansion and contraction. The function of this mid-area has never been really identified, but it must have something to do with reciprocal adjustment between the inner and the outer zones of the force center. It is believed by many that the mid-zone is the control mechanism of the mid-space or quiet zones which separate the successive space levels of the master universe, but no evidence or revelation confirms this. This inference is derived from the knowledge that this mid-area is in some manner related to the functioning of the non-pervaded space mechanism of the master universe.
Okay, just one, you know, give you a little sense of why they make that logical statement at the end there. This inference is derived from, you know, they're saying, okay, they're thinking about it logically. What is it that they're thinking? I mean, notice what they tell you, that one of the things that they know is associated with this mid-zone is a generalized expansion and contraction. Okay. Now, you know, those who've read the book for years know that when we start talking about pervaded space and unpervaded space, this expansion and contraction phenomenon, it's not just pervaded space that expands and contracts, it's also unpervaded space that expands and contracts. See? So the very fact that they know this zone has to do with that expansion contraction, it means it has to have something, some association with non-pervaded space or unpervaded space. Okay. Okay. But, you know, that's about the limits of what they can infer, as they say. See? Yeah. But that's why they're saying that. It's just that simple. I mean, or at the very least, it's that. I mean, that's enough to make their, you know, that inference. They may have other things, you know, make strengthen that inference, but okay.
The outer zone is the largest and most active of the three concentric and elliptical belts of unidentified space potential. This area is the site of unimagined activities the central circuit point of emanations, which proceed spaceward in every direction to the outermost borders of the seven super universes, and on beyond to overspread the enormous and incomprehensible domains of all outer space. This space presence is entirely impersonal, notwithstanding that in some undisclosed manner it seems to be indirectly responsive to the will and mandates of the infinite deities when acting as the Trinity. This is believed to be the central focalization, the paradise center of the space presence of the unqualified absolute.
Okay, that last little bit there. The first part about when acting as the Trinity, you know, when acting as a non-personal expression, so the domain of Nether Paradise, what fact holds dominion over that nether domain? What fact is at the center of the nether, the co-infinite one, okay? Paradise Trinity, okay? Yeah, so that's what that's about. I mean, that's obviously, it's not the personal deity presence, okay? That, it's from an individuality viewpoint, you have the Paradise Trinity as the superadditive consequence of the deities, and so you say at the infinite deities when acting as, okay? But the whole point is, the co-infinite one holds dominion over the nether domain. Okay. And we've got the unqualified absolute, or the infinite capacity. And the details are too complex, but you notice it's twice now. Let's see, where was the other one? Can't remember. The innermost is the focal point of the force energy activities. Okay. I mean, it keeps, here we have it directly, focalization. Those of us who have been working on this, wait a minute, focalization, that's a mother word. Why is that coming in here? Okay. The thing is, that's mother at the highest level where it really transcends the words father and mother. I mean, if you look at the psychic circle chart, you can just see that. You go up the cosmic mothers, and what's in the gray box is a little annotation here, the infinite upholder. Okay. The relationship of the infinite upholder to the infinite capacity produces sort of the most transcendent expression of focalization. That's what that's alluding to. Nether Paradise directly, it's just the infinite capacity. But what, they keep pointing out that it's that there's a focus, that things get zoomed down and identified onto. What's bringing, say, the unqualified absolute to a focus point on Nether Paradise? Where's that focalization coming from? That's the functioning of the infinite upholder in relationship to the infinite capacity, which is the unqualified absolute, and it leads to that focalization. Okay, so that's so you notice that we in between the lines you have the universal absolute, the infinite upholder. So you actually have all three. So you have the deity absolute, the unqualified absolute, and the universal. All three of them are actually mentioned here. But only one is directly identified, and that's the unqualified absolute, the infinite capacity.
So, anything that's impersonal may seem separate from the personal, mm-hmm. but in reality, the personal is always there. Directing.
Right. Again, because you have that basic picture that we described a little bit. No matter if you're thinking in the individuality viewpoint story or the unity viewpoint story, there's that which acts, the infinite one. Okay, that's always You know, there's always the initiate. That's always behind everything. You know, and in a sort of a totally manifested state, maybe a little bit more along what you're thinking, the Father, God the Father, doesn't just engage what's going on out here personally. He doesn't just engage it as the universal Father. He also engages it as the universal controller. Through the aisle, he grabs a hold of things non-personally. Okay? So, yeah, I mean, that which acts, the infinite one, you know, whatever you want to say, total will, the reservoir of all will, et cetera, all those initial points of the story that, I mean, that's always behind everything. There's a reason why it's the first source and center of all things and beings. Okay, whether or not you think about an individuality viewpoint or a unity viewpoint, there's always that nucleus of that which acts. Yeah. So then read that fourth paragraph then.
All forms of force and all phases of energy seem to be encircuited. They circulate throughout the universes and return by definite routes. But with the emanations of the activated zone of the unqualified absolute, there appears to be either an outgoing or an incoming, never both simultaneously. This outer zone pulsates in age-long cycles of gigantic proportions. For a little more than 1 billion Urantia years, the space force of this center is outgoing. Then, for a similar length of time, it will be incoming. And the space force manifestations of this center are universal. They extend throughout all pervadable space.
Okay. So now let's step back and think about these four things. Okay. And an important clue that they give you to how to start unpacking this is in the place where you might not start to look, this mid-zone of these three. Because there, they gave you the really important clue that you have three different cycles of activity, and they have a hierarchy in terms of magnitude of that activity. The greatest is the general expansion contraction. And then there's whatever the heck is associated with the north-south, and then whatever the heck it is associated with the east-west. Well, that's convenient. The biggest thing is something that I actually think I maybe know something about initially. So let's start with that one. Okay. That basic expansion contraction fact. Back in the 20s, Hubble noticed that all the galaxies, were moving away. Okay. Science knows about this. Okay. What they don't know is that you have this respiration phenomenon, that there's an equilibrium size. It didn't start at zero and magically bang, and it was made as an equilibrium size, and it respirates about that equilibrium size. Okay, and that's the next section about space respiration. But we're thinking about the force charge inside of that space that's respirating, and it's synchronized with it. Okay, and there's this expansion and contraction. Now, how to basically think about that? It's like, we always talk about the master universe and this big pattern at the center of the whole thing, at the center of symmetry of that whole big pattern, we say is the aisle. Well, not quite. I mean, that whole big symmetry pattern is a finite space picture. The aisle's not in finite space. Yeah, you got a question?
More of a comment. Don't the Buddhists believe that they talk about the breath of Brahma and that they're talking about something similar?
Right. And a Christian would say our God is a living God. I mean, it's like, even the primitives tightly tied the notion of life to breath and the movement of the chest and the breathing. The lungs having an equilibrium size and expanding and contracting about that equilibrium size. Yeah, I mean, wow. It's just like right there. It's like the lungs of God. Okay? Our God is a living God, and the entire universe expresses it. Okay? Amen? All right. Everything is in motion. Our God is a living God. Okay, but that expansion contraction. I was saying, you have this picture we always paint that has this center of symmetry, the center of the central universe. Everything is, oriented about that center point. But the aisle isn't actually there. Now, if you travel in finite space, the aisle is aspatial. It's not in finite space. It's like, well, okay, but so it's somewhere outside of what I know, and it's going to impose its influence on where I am. How does it do it? Well, it doesn't do it by reaching in at that point at the center and pushing out from that center point. This expansion and contraction of the force charge of space isn't, pushing out from the center of symmetry and then contracting back towards that center of symmetry. It's not a vectorial motion like that, radially outward and inward from the center point of this central universe. Okay, while the greatest fluctuation is in every direction. Okay, how does that happen? Okay. The Isle of Paradise, see, this has a little, this is where, you're tied to the beginnings of thinking about particle physics and stuff, and that center of influence at the center of the nucleus of an automaton. This expansion and contraction flow, just kind of think about it, a flow of a fluid sort of here, This flow doesn't just enter the center and push out and suck back, down the drain and push out. Okay. The Isle of Paradise touches every single point of space simultaneously. And so think about this point. Right now there's an expansion. At this point, it's flowing in at that point. And at this point, it's flowing in at that point. This point. At every single point, there's an expansion. Okay? So it's not going to have any sort of point of origin. It's just going to be a generalized expansion. It's not going to be a vector motion. It's going to be a scalar motion. Okay? It's just outward, expanding at every point. So, it's just like the analogy they use when they imagine that space-time is a substance and it's expanding in their general relativity Big Bang model. They use the raisin cake baking in the oven and rising. If you stand on any raisin in the raisin cake, all the other raisins are moving away from you. And it's not because you're standing on the special raisin. You can stand on any raisin and all the other raisins are moving away from you. It's a generalized expansion. It's not a vectorial expansion. It's not exploding out from a particular raisin. Okay? It's just rising in the oven. Okay? Same thing here. Okay? And that's because the Isle of Paradise and this generalized expansion contraction, is initiating at every point. So that's what the outer zone is about. I mean, obviously all the mechanics of it are, deeply mysterious to even them. Okay. But you've got these three things and they're saying that cycle is tied to that outer zone, this generalized expansion contraction. Okay. Let's go where it's simplest to think about that expansion contraction. Let's go to the central universe, where everything there, in the picture that we're given, all the circuits, all three paradise circuits and all seven Havona circuits are all on a plane. Okay, so expansion and contraction there is just, those 10 circuits moving, getting farther apart and closer together in the plane. Okay, and so you can think of this generalized expansion and contraction there is just, radially outward in that plane. That's what this outer zone is going to do to the central universe. Okay, now remember when we first were talking about the Isle of Paradise, and we said, well, why isn't it a perfect sphere? Why is the symmetry fully broken? All three dimensions are different. You know, it's not even a circular disc. It's an elliptical disc. So it's different north, south, than east, west, and definitely different both of those than up, down. Okay. You know, and that gives rise to the fact that we have a three-dimensional reality, X, Y, Z. You know, up, down, left, right. You know, forward, backward. You have three dimensions, both finite and absolute, because of that difference between the three. Okay, so you know that fundamentally, that's a basic pattern that the Isle is imposing. So when they say, so those other two cycles, go to the next strongest one. This thing that they say is associated with the north-south. Okay, if they say that there is another one of these cycles, besides this generalized expansion contraction, another cycle that's associated with the north-south, okay, if I'm in the central universe and the expansion is in the plane here, so it's just radially out and in, okay, some other flow different than that flow that paradise is going to impose would have to be at right angles to that direction. Okay. In particular, it's like this, okay? That next thing, besides paradise imposing this generalized expansion contraction, it imposes a flow orthogonal to that, at right angles to that. Oh, and that's where they talked about always obedient to paradise gravity, circular gravity. That's the source of the circuits, the flows. See, you have motion, but it's being patterned. It's being patterned into this and patterned into flows. Yeah, the force charge of space manifests this macroscopic motion of the expansion contraction first, second most important, the flows. Like in the central universe, all of them flow around the center of symmetry in a clockwise direction. Okay. Now again, think about this. This is the Isle that's, you know, that here is the highest source of this. The Isle is absolutely transcendent of space. Okay, so the Isle has no way of differentiating between clockwise and counterclockwise in what it would impose. The clockwise and counterclockwise are the same to the Isle. Okay. Oh. Okay, yeah, and we kind of see that because they aren't all clockwise or all counterclockwise. They're alternate. Okay, and how does it go? Well, the 10 circuits in the central universe are clockwise, and then the first circuit of dark gravity bodies in the gravity belt there, dark gravity bodies goes counterclockwise, and then the second circuit dark gravity bodies goes clockwise again, and then the super universe level goes counterclockwise, you know, etc. on out. Okay. The Isle can't impose a differential. The dark gravity bodies are in between the Isle and us. Okay, they can impose things that are not uniform. They can make it so that the Isle's influence is imposed in a non-uniform fashion. For instance, you know, there's this level. It's not all just one level. You know, and this level is this big. And this level flows in this direction. All those differences the Isle can impose. That's through the dark gravity bodies that gets imposed. It's like, well, if the dark gravity bodies are going to make some, you know, are going to be the direct source of some things being clockwise and some things being counterclockwise, well, then the dark gravity bodies have to know about clockwise and counterclockwise. Ah, there's two circuits of them. One is counterclockwise and one is clockwise. And that's why. There has to be two circuits so that they can impose some of the flows being clockwise and some being counterclockwise. Okay? And in all deeply mysterious ways, they decide on how big the levels are and all that sort of stuff. Okay? You got another question?
So if the universe is breathing or expanding, then everything within it would also have to be...
Yeah, everything... The foundation, remember, we're just talking about the force charge. The foundation of the whole physical reality has these patterns imposed upon it, like the generalized expansion contraction. The foundation of the physical reality is expanding and contracting. So everything built upon it is expanding and contracting. Okay? Or at least it has that influence imposed on it. Maybe there's other things that, you know, that dominate, and so that isn't immediately manifest, but the influence is there. Everything feels that influence as a foundation.
As a physicist, can you tell me, would it seem like this, the dark gravity bodies switching the direction of things, does that impose a kind of stability on the whole?
Yeah, they talk about that a little bit. Yeah, that's the whole point. I mean, all the alternate levels and stuff, I mean, you know, obviously we're not going to be able to sort that out, but in detail. But that's the generalized point. It's about stabilizing, right, you know, the whole picture. Yeah, and that comes up later in the paper. Okay, so now think about a little more of the details. See, how did they describe this? They said that there was this sort of pressure presence differential north to south, and that it was uniform. It always is. You know, definitely greater at the north end. Okay? So there's this uniform, this constant differential. Okay? And they kind of gave you this visualization. It's like coming out the north and going in the south. Oh, well, this is like clockwise and this is like counterclockwise. See, even in picturizing like that, which is obviously going to be crude, but just that simple circulatory like picture, see, has both, yeah, both handedness. Okay, like I said, I mean, the aisle can't distinguish, and so any valid analogy of what the aisle is doing can't have a preference, or it's not going to be a true analogy of this phenomenon, which is absolutely transcendent of spatial things that we can understand. But, you know, we're trying to make spatial pictures to understand it. Okay. So that constant differential, it never switches, and it's definitely greater on the south end. Okay, it's constant. So in other words, you know, you don't have the central universe circuits going clockwise, then, you know, and then turning around. Okay, it never changes directions. Okay, it's always in the same direction. Okay, because that differential is constant. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, now the third, well, the least of the three. They say that from time to time, there are also noted differences in the east-west pressures. Okay, so we've got three orthogonal dimensions. Okay, if you're in the central universe, okay, and the expansion contraction is in the plane like this, and the flow is at right angles to that, okay? Okay, there's a, what about up, down? Okay. So, and notice that it's not uniform. You know, this is the way they word it. Sometimes it's greater on the east, sometimes greater on the west. Okay. Okay. Just, oh, what's it trying to do? Think about it. Not so much maybe with the central universe, but there's envision it there first. Okay, the circuits of the central universe are in the plane. Well, what if they start to drift off? Right. See, you've got this. There's a variation that occurs that's keeping them in the plane. The paradise is actively regulating that. Now think about it out here. You know, think about it in the outer space levels. You know, get past the super universe. Get us out there where it really starts to get tall. You know, getting way out there. And you've got all of these giant super clusters and all this stuff. You know, if things start to get too lopsided on one side or the other, paradise regulates that. So that in general, it's, you know, it has a center of mass, as it were, in a plane. That east-west, see, so the east-west of paradise manifests up-down out here. The north-south manifests, you know, around, tangential.
Yeah, in both directions.
Yeah, in both directions. Okay. And you can not just take it out here. While the greatest fluctuation is in every direction, I mean, you don't just have to have this, what you'd call a cylindrical coordinate system in the central universe, you know, where you have one coordinate that's in this plane and then the two are right angles. You know, go out here and use a spherical coordinate system. Okay, so that in out, okay, can be at any angle here, okay, and you still have a flow that's orthogonal to it, okay, and a regulating, you know, adjustment, you know, that's orthogonal to it this way to keep everything. Okay, that's what these three are.
Doesn't that just remind you of everything?
Okay, that's why it was so important to notice. Right up front, it's like, wait a minute, there's a symmetry in all three dimensions is broken. Oh, that's why we have three dimensions. You've got to have that as a very foundation thing, or you're never going to be able to think this through, unpack this, okay? And that should really help you to understand how you can't think of this aisle as literally being in space, okay? Its north-southness, you know, turns into this circle or this ellipse. You know, it's the set of lines that are orthogonal to the radial. That's paradise north-southness. Okay, paradise east-west-westness is along these arcs. Okay. And then there's the every. Okay. So
that's cool.
That's unpacking all that. Okay. And see, so now you can see you have the lesser two are in the inner zone. You know, and then the big one, the expansion and contraction, is the outer zone. And then the mid zone is obviously, is balancing between these two. More of this equilibrium system that has to be, like alternate levels and space reservoirs and all this stuff that's designed to make this a stable system. Okay. You know? Yep.
The image occurs on the gyroscope and stability. Talking about has to do with the motion. The gyroscope mm-hmm. just sits on its side,
right.
Doing nothing
right.
Unless it's moving.
Yeah, it's very. I mean, it's very important. It's, you know, as soon as you can to let loose of static pictures as much as you can, because everything is in motion. So the more you can begin to think of the whole thing dynamically, the better. But it's hard to think about everything initially dynamically. You know, so you kind of start and build up. But yeah, that's. It's a dynamic equilibrium, not a static equilibrium. Very much so. Right. It's just this incredible, complex system of motion, all with this perfect pattern imposed upon it, so that everything is in perfect equilibrium.
Okay. Do you know how a counter-rotational gyroscope precesses?
No.
It doesn't. Anti-gravity? It doesn't. Recession will cancel.
Just in other words, you know, you can, the on-ramp for a lot of this understanding of a more dynamic universe can be found in things that we already are aware of, you know, and generalizing those and beginning to, Yeah, let things flow free. All right, let's read that last paragraph.
All physical force, energy, and matter are one. All force energy originally proceeded from Nether Paradise and will eventually return thereto following the completion of its space circuit. But the energies and material organizations of the universe of universes did not all come from Nether Paradise in their present phenomenal states. Space is a womb of several forms of matter and prematter. Though the outer zone of the Paradise Force Center is the source of space energies, space does not originate there. Space is not force, energy, or power. Nor do the pulsations of this zone account for the respiration of space. But the incoming and outgoing phases of this zone are synchronized with the 2 billion year expansion-contraction cycles of space.
All right. So, you know, we certainly don't know about the the mechanisms of space, but we know where the anchor point is, okay? It's that zone that immediately surrounds the zone of infinity, okay? And there's things that are just completely mysterious to all, you know, celestial beings too, about, you know, what goes on, okay? But, you know, you can really think of it as this fundamental interface between non-personal deity and its embrace of infinity and stuff. Space is the interface between those two. Yeah.
The Buddhists believe that the breath out is 1 billion years and the breath in is 1 billion years. They must have been reading the arrangement. It's not like just a coincidence.
You know, it can either be an auto-revelatory thing, or it can be something that's tailing from way back, you know, with an epical revelation. Yeah. Someone being told something and, you know, I don't know. It's probably more likely an auto-revelatory thing, but, yeah. I mean, obviously it could be just a coincidence, but it seems kind of odd to be merely coincidence. Yeah, let's just think about this a little bit more. Since so you step back.
Not a very long session.
No, it is short, and really it's pretty straightforward, except for talking about the answer to his question, because that's actually the one thing that kind of comes out of that. So we can pick that up next time. But notice the power of how we've begun to unpack the book, what we can bring to bear now. Mm-hmm. See, I hope you can start to see that. See, it's starting to get to understanding the actual stuff that we're made out of and things, okay? And the only way to get at that in any sort of a logical picture, instead of just like, you know, magical, you've got to have a unity viewpoint. And you have to have a real solid consecration to recognizing the logical anchor points, you know, in the book. You have to ask why, for instance, is the aisle an elliptical pancake? Okay? And the more you can answer that question, the more you can take the other paragraphs out of the mystical domain and begin to really figure out exactly what's going on here. You can start in kind of a simple way of thinking about just this fluid that flows. So in other words, there's flowingness afoot, and the aisle imposes some pattern upon that flowingness. You know, it has this threefold hierarchy of a pattern that it imposes upon that desire to flow, that intent. Okay? Does something ring a bell there? Here we're talking about the infinite capacity. I am that which extends. We're not talking about the infinite potential tied to upper paradise. I am that which intends. See, there is an intent afoot in the universe, and it makes things move. Motion comes from that intent. Okay? But there has to be form for that intent. Intent can't exist in a formless domain. So the intent that comes from upper paradise flows in forms, you know, in patterns imposed by nether paradise. You know, and I am that which extends, you know, the infinite capacity, everything about that, see, is this form, okay?
So got womb and form, like three wombs
apart. Yeah, right. Right. See, that is, it's all there to be reckoned. And begin to, and it's like, okay, and like Steve was saying about this, the pattern being the source for things, you know, and I said, yeah, the source for everything. Think about what this says about you. Okay, we just ground through all of this complicated stuff about scalar motion and orthogonal, you know, things and whatnot, and zones of infinity and co-infinite ones. And okay, what does all this say about you? It says something very important about you. Okay, you, if you're going to be real, you have to be an expression of the nature of the isle. You have to have the manifestation of intent in form. If you just have form and no intent, you're so earthly minded, you're no heavenly good. If you just have intent, no form, you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. You have to have relationship to both upper paradise and nether paradise, or you're not real. You have to have both material consciousness and spiritual consciousness, or you're not real. You don't relate to the isle. You're adrift. You have no anchor. You're not part of reality. If you're not like the isle, you're not anchored on the isle, you're not real. You're not part of the cosmos.
As above, so below kind of thinking.
Yes, always. Because everything comes down from the sources and centers.
So when you look at a fractal, you look at the tiny piece, and you actually see the whole. Isn't that like the same
hologram
thing you're talking about?
Hologram.
Well, hologram, or, you know, or fractals, or, yeah. I mean, those sorts of things. I mean, that certainly, you know, helps you kind of think about how the aisle can be a source point for every point in space and things like that. But take it out of the, take it out of the abstract. Take it into your life. How does, what about this is a truth that I can obey? Okay? I'm not reading this book to get a bunch of facts about nether paradise. I'm reading this book to get truth because I want to obey something. I can't obey fact. I want to transform everything about my life because of this book. And there isn't a single section in the book that doesn't change everything in your life. You need to figure that out. Okay, the truth of this. The truth is the indispensability of form and your identification to form, duty. Okay? You can't exist without form and the duty to it. Okay? A way that this whole expression of form can be immediately understood in the three cosmic intuitions. Okay? You have these three levels, these three cosmic intuitions. And that first cosmic intuition, that foundational level of the objective domain, think of it literally. It's literally a floor. Okay? Okay, and then I go up to the next level. How does that manifest? Literally, in an analogy that I can see and then understand through. I have a floor because of the first cosmic intuition. Second cosmic intuition gives me walls. Okay. I now have a container with a bottom and sides. Those sides, what's that second level? That second level domain is duty. Okay? Causation. There has to be a foundation, a logical foundation. And then walls of duty. And now you have a full form. And then and only then, the third level, I can now pour the liquid of the of relationship to the that sixth level of meaning, the third cosmic intuition. I can pour it into something and hold it, make it mine. It's not going to just pour out on a table, for instance, and wash away. Okay, I'm gonna hold it. It's going to be part of me. I can make soul out of something that has a bottom, sides, and is filled. All three of those things can be made into a brick of soul. If it's missing a bottom, nothing, no soul. Missing sides, no soul. It's missing content, no soul. Okay? All three. Okay? And the very difficult thing, you know, for spiritual consciousness, especially ever-heightening spiritual consciousness in the wake of very primitive institutional forms and notions, okay, that impatience of spiritual consciousness wants to reject form in the face of stupid form, okay? Okay, you can't reject form. You reject reality. It doesn't matter how much you intend. None of that is made soul. Because you have no vessel for that intent. And intent without a vessel flows right through you. It has no survival value in you. Yeah?
Inner life of good.
Right. You can share your inner life with goodness. But you can't make soul out of that. You have to share your inner life with God. And where's God? Okay? Is it just God floating in free space? No. It's God standing on form. Okay? You have to have a relationship with the whole package. Okay? And so, this is the very important part about this in terms of you and how this changes your life. You're going to go forth and you're not going to reject form anymore. You've rediscovered the truth of form, the goodness of form, the fact of form. Okay? You're going to reform. Okay?
Form up.
You know, you may have broken away from Catholicism and deformed, and now it's time to reform. Now it's time to reform. Now it's time for duty again. Because when you deform, you're a zero miler. Okay? And you'd like to be a second miler. But in order to become a second miler, you have to be a first miler first. You can't get to second miler status except through duty. Causation, duty, worship. You can't get to worship except through duty. Any worship that you think you achieve that isn't through duty is not true worship. It's the illusion of worship. True worship is on the other side of duty. Worship is what you're pouring into. It's not genuinely there. It's an illusion if there isn't an actual vessel that you're pouring that into. Okay? Okay. So that's, you know, why do we languish in futile yearning? What's the rest of it? Because we obey not the truth. Okay. Spiritually conscious individuals on this planet languish in futile yearning because they obey not the truth. Their life consists of regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Why are they vainly hoping for the future? Because they're trying to pour a fluid into nothing. There is no vessel. All of their efforts are in vain. All the sharing the inner life with goodness in the universe is in vain. It has no survival value. Okay?
What place does it have in the
this distinction is vital, see? Okay? Yeah, that's why this stuff is important. That's why it's important to think about paradise, to develop a relationship with the fact of form, the truth of form in your life. How on earth could there be any stability in the universe if there wasn't this form imposed? How could there be a super universe level if the aisle didn't make a super universe level? How could you live here if there was no here? Okay? You have to make sure there's a here in order to live there. Okay? So, take delight in cultivating all three cosmic intuitions. So there's a bottom and walls, and then what you're really, you know, yearning for, truth that's held in a vessel. Okay, that's there and you obey it. Right. So just keep that in mind, and you'll see, you know, they build to that too, come to the end of the paper. You know, they crescendo this, you know, into you. But in the midst, right in the very dead center of the paper here, it's easy to lose sight of the personal picture. I mean, they started us by saying, okay, this doesn't have anything to do with personality, you know, or spirit intelligences, not even the deity absolute. It's like, well, okay, this doesn't have anything to do with me, blah, 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 blah. No, it has everything to do with you. Okay. Yeah. You know, we're made in the image of the whole picture, not just part of the picture. Everything. If you, you know, actually possessed capacity, you wouldn't languish in futile yearning anymore. You'd be moving and you'd be excited. All right, let's take a moment here.